Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 19th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Above the fold on the front page, New York firm buys Clayton Urgent Care Group, by James Gallagher. From Clayton, a New York private equity group with $1 billion under management has bought and plans to expand a homegrown Clayton firm that operates urgent care centers. The Comvest Group now owns Urgent Cares of America, which has 6 emergency care centers in Wake County and another 3 across the state. Neither the buyer nor the seller would disclose the purchase price. The Comvest Group focuses on small medical device makers and healthcare services, though this is its first foray into the urgent care market. Roger Marrero, a managing partner with Comvest, says the firm likes Urgent Cares of America's management team and sees opportunity in the urgent care market to grow. Marrero says growth will come organically and through acquisition, first in North Carolina and then likely beyond. Jason Williams, who is relinquishing his position as Urgent Care's CEO, but will stay on as president of the Southeast region, says he would like to see the company grow to between 200 and 500 locations over the next 5 years, which would require an investment of $50 million to $100 million. Marrero was not willing to commit to such aggressive numbers. "I think we're at 9 today, so the plan is to grow incrementally," he says. Comvest is rounding out a new management team to run and grow the operation. John Randazzo, the former CEO of Healthcare Innovations and Value Health, will take over as CEO, while Dr. Charles Saunders, former chief medical officer for the Healthion and WebMD, will serve as board chair. Any growth in the business would be well-timed, as the National Healthcare Reform Law puts an emphasis on the use of urgent care centers to help reduce overcrowding in emergency departments and reduce the cost of care. "An urgent care is a reasonable alternative to emergency departments for treatment," says Sharon Green, a professor of health policy within UNC Chapel Hill's Gillings School of Global Public Health. "Studies show that as many as 80% of procedures performed in an emergency department can be done in urgent care centers. And because urgent cares do not handle major acute care issues, meaning they don't need as much expensive equipment, and because they operate in smaller, less expensive facilities, such as strip malls and other retail areas, the overhead is less, lowering the cost of treatment." Williams says care in one of his centers often costs 10% to 20% of what a trip to a hospital emergency room would cost. As of now, the urgent care market tends to be fairly fragmented, with local hospitals and doctors often owning urgent care centers. There are few national players. Green says the closest thing to a national urgent care model is CVS Pharmacy, which is putting nurse practitioners in many of its locations to treat minor ailments. Still, because they are not staffed by medical doctors, CVS's minute clinics are not able to offer the same level of care as an urgent care, and sometimes have to refer patients to urgent cares or emergency departments. "Urgent Cares of America is not trying to compete against hospitals," says Williams. "Rather, the goal is to complement the hospitals by providing some of the services offered in an emergency room, but leaving the major issues to the hospital." Center article on the front page, North Carolina's own stroke belt. "Only 16 counties have fully equipped staff hospitals," by James Gallagher. From Raleigh, more than 5 million of North Carolina's 9.4 million residents live in counties that do not have primary stroke care centers, putting them at a high risk of long-term disability or death. The state has 23 hospitals in only 16 of its 100 counties that are designated as primary stroke care centers, meaning they are fully equipped to treat strokes. Individuals living in those 16 counties are less likely to die from a stroke than those living in the other 84, according to figures compiled by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. With the window of time for treating a stroke being little more than 4 hours, Not having immediate access to substantive care is a major issue for an aging population. Despite a concerted effort by healthcare officials over the past decade to boost stroke prevention measures, stroke remains the fourth leading cause of death in North Carolina, accounting for nearly 4,700 deaths in 2008, and the Tar Heel State has the fifth highest mortality rate from strokes in the U.S. Advances in medical treatment, including the clot-busting drug TPA, have reduced mortality rates and improved the outcomes for many stroke patients. But failing to get the proper diagnosis, testing, and treatment in time could lead to death or long-term disability. The clock is ticking. Every minute that goes by, the likelihood of benefit from medical treatment goes down and down and down, says Larry Goldstein, director of Duke University Medical Center's Stroke Center. The General Assembly has commissioned a group called the Justice Warren Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Task Force to compile an action plan that would work to reduce the number of people having strokes by promoting preventive measures as well as improving access to acute stroke care throughout the state. The task force will present its ideas to state legislatures in early December and release its final recommendations before the end of the year. Our overall hope is that hopefully you won't have a stroke, but if you do, wherever you are, there will be a level of care for you, says Anita Holmes, the task force executive director. Among the recommendations that could be proposed are improved education of emergency medical service personnel and the general public to be better able to recognize signs of stroke, improved stroke rehabilitation centers, and enhanced use of telemedicine to allow doctors in other parts of the state to review scans and lab results and offer advice on treatment. Currently, the bulk of the primary stroke centers are located in the central part of the state and in and around urban centers. There is only one such facility east of Raleigh, where stroke mortality rates are highest in the state. That facility is at East Carolina University's Teaching Hospital. The eastern part of the state has the highest stroke mortality rates, according to the CDC. In a stretch of counties from Duplin in the south to Vance and Gates in the north, the stroke mortality rate hovers between 138 and 145 deaths per 100,000, compared to a statewide average of 125 per 100,000. The national mortality rate is 95 per 100,000. It's pretty bad in North Carolina, says Anna Felix, a neurologist at UNC Hospitals, adding that across the southeast, incidence and death from stroke is higher than in the rest of the nation. While those numbers have been tracked, no study has fully determined why the Southeast is the nation's stroke belt. While health officials say more needs to be done to prevent strokes, the lack of equipped facilities throughout the state is a major concern. To be a primary stroke center, hospitals must invest substantial sums on equipment and personnel. Hospitals must continually operate pharmacies, labs, and computed tomography, or CT, scanners, machines that take the three-dimensional x-rays of the brain and that can cost $1.5 million or more, depending on the model. Those operations require additional people, such as lab technicians and radiologists. Because of the budget issues, many small rural hospitals have such equipment, but will only staff them part-time. Goldstein says the task force is trying to find solutions to such issues. Down in Columbus or New Hanover or Brunswick County, there is nothing there, he says. And that is what we're trying to do something about. Still on the front page, Dominion gets new unit going, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Cary. With one major apartment project ready to break ground in the spring, Dominion Realty Partners of Raleigh is making preparations for a second one of similar size. Dominion is putting together the final touches before turning dirt for a $30 million complex called Triangle Place, which would be the first apartment project undertaken by the Raleigh company since bringing on board multifamily expert Tom Barker in 2009. At the same time, Barker is spearheading plans to build a high-density apartment community at the corner of Tryon Road and Cary Parkway in Cary. First, though, Dominion must convince neighboring residents and Cary town officials that the project will fit with the site. Andy Andrews, president and CEO of Dominion, says he hopes to break ground on Triangle Place before April. We started looking at doing apartments 2 years ago, but it takes a while to find the right property and pull a deal together, he says. Dominion is seeking approval to rezone the 12.5-acre site where a community to be known as Tryon Place at Cary Parkway would be built. The developer plans to build up to 256 units in four buildings of four stories each. All of the units would be built atop basement garage parking, meet green building standards, and have access to elevators, says Barker, who headed Trammell Crowe Residential's Raleigh office before it was closed. Cary's Planning and Zoning Board voted 6-3 on November 16th to recommend approval of a comprehensive plan amendment for the Tryon Place site, says Cary planner Dan Matthays. But the project still must go through a series of approvals from the town council. Although most commercial development projects are on hold due to the slowdown in the economy, the multifamily industry has been making a comeback in recent months as occupancy levels in rental units continues to rise. Dominion's Triangle Place apartment community will have 338 units in five buildings on a site near Triangle Town Center in North Raleigh. Cary real estate investor Roy Mashburn says he was impressed with Dominion's plans when Dominion submitted an offer to buy the vacant site from him and his investment partner, Raleigh lawyer Gary Joyner. Mashburn and Joyner bought the 12.5-acre site in March 2008 for less than $1.5 million. Dominion has the land under contract to buy, but neither party would reveal the sale price. At the bottom of the front page, owners of Raleigh Rock Quarry want to dig 169 more acres. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. Owners of a rock quarry along Duralee Road, that's become somewhat of a landmark since digging began in the 1940s, want to begin mining 169 additional acres to the west, and they're working to remove roadblocks for what's likely to be a controversial proposal. Since mining began at Crabtree Quarry, now owned by Texas-based Hanson Aggregates, residential and retail development has blossomed, and vehicular traffic has multiplied along and near Duralee Road. With that in mind, officials with Hanson say they'll make the current quarry pit available to be flooded as a flood control measure in exchange for the rezoning of the 169 acres along Ebenezer Church Road targeted for new quarry operations. The flood control option would help maintain Crabtree Creek within its banks during heavy rains. The creek is the culprit in the flooding that can become extensive at the lower levels near Crabtree Valley Mall and at auto dealerships and other businesses along Wake Forest Road near Six Forks Road. Multiple engineering and geographical reports since the early 1990s have recommended using Hanson's Crabtree Quarry as a flood reservoir for Crabtree Creek. But many of the quarry's neighbors and city leaders opposed Hanson's plans to open a new mine on the south side of the creek. Hanson's leaders now have agreed to halt plans to mine on the south side of the creek if the property to the west is rezoned to industrial use from its current status as a residential neighborhood. If we get the rezoning, we wouldn't need to mine south of the creek, says Chris Ward, vice president and general manager of Hanson's Southeast business. The rezoning request filed in September is expected to be on the agenda for a public hearing at a City Council and Planning Commission meeting on January 18th. Hanson has reached a deal with Raleigh real estate developer Michael Sandman to buy the 169 acres to the west of the quarry, where Sandman had planned to build a neighborhood of high-end homes. Sandman's Hamptons Development Company, LLC, has already built the roads and some of the infrastructure for what was expected to be Phase 2 of the Hamptons at Umstead community. Home prices at the Hamptons start in the 600,000s. Sandman says he has sold 16 of the 100 lots in the first phase, and he acknowledges it could be many years before enough homes are finished to begin Phase 2. For us, it's a financially neutral transaction with Hanson compared to selling developed lots. But it's a few dollars today, he says. To sweeten the pot, Hanson has offered to allow easements through its property to connect the city's existing Crabtree Creek Greenway to trails in Umstead Park. It would donate 9 acres of rhododendron forest along Crabtree Creek for a park or natural heritage preserve, and it would build a 40-space parking lot to improve access to the greenway in nearby Umstead Park. "We feel this is very much a win-win proposal," says Grace Dyers, a Raleigh land use attorney representing Hansen in the rezoning case. "The choice is to maintain the status quo operating out there, or make plans that will benefit the future of the city of Raleigh and the surrounding areas." Hansen Aggregates Southeast LLC is a subsidiary of Germany's Heidelberg Cement Group, which took over ownership of the Hansen Quarry operations in 2007. Inside the front cover, GOP's Burger, cut state spending by 15%, by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, the presumed incoming leader of the North Carolina Senate says he'll push for a 15% across-the-board cut in state spending to help fill a $3 billion-plus revenue hole in next year's budget. Phil Burger, an Eden attorney who is expected to be elected president pro tem of the upper chamber, also says he's opposed to extending tax increases implemented by lawmakers in 2009 to plug an earlier budget gap. "I believe that reducing the overall level of spending is the only way to put North Carolina in a more competitive position," says Berger, a Republican who has spent 5 terms in the Senate representing Guilford and Rockingham counties. The budget gap next year has been estimated to be anywhere between $3.2 billion to $4 billion. State fiscal researchers have been using the $3.2 billion figure as their starting point. With state general fund spending currently in the $18.9 billion range, a 15% cut would shave the gap figure by $2.8 billion. Berger says he hopes the deficit can be narrowed further by cost-cutting moves being put in place by Governor Beverly Perdue. She has asked departments of state government to examine spending reduction scenarios of up to 15%. "The governor will provide us with a carryover," says Berger. "It's hard to know what position the state will be in," he says. "We're not sure what we're going to find until we start looking under the hood." Lawmakers closed a 2009 revenue gap by passing a temporary sales tax increase and imposing an income tax surcharge. Extending those taxes could provide extra cash as the General Assembly debates a new 2-year state spending plan. But Berger, for one, removes all doubt on the question, saying flatly that he's opposed to any extension of the taxes. "I don't intend to support that," he says. "I think this is what the people elected us to do." Berger and the Senate alone won't set the course for the state takes as it struggles to get along with less. Control in the House is also passing into GOP hands, with the early contenders for the speakership being Apex attorney Paul Stamm and Cornelius management consultant Tom Tillis. "It's going to be interesting as we move from the political season into the governing season," says John Quintero, a policy analyst with Chapel Hill-based South by North Strategies. "The choices face lawmakers next year won't be easy ones," he said. "It is easy to talk about where you'd like to cut," says Quintero, "but what cuts really mean are lost jobs." Democrats, who have had a major say in budgetary matters in the past, are waiting for the General Assembly's new leadership picture to come into better focus. "We're going to be on the sidelines this time," says Representative Pryor Gibson, a Democrat from Wadesboro. "We're fortunate to have smart people on the other side of the aisle, and it's their turn." Part of the reason for next year's budget headache is the drying up of $1.6 billion in federal stimulus money. That loss will be offset somewhat by the fact that the state tax collections, after months of decline, finally turned the corner in July, according to a November outlook penned by General Assembly fiscal researcher Barry Boardman. From July through October, sales tax collections rose by 0.8%, compared with a 12% decline for the comparable period in 2009. Payroll withholding collections rose by 1.2% during the July-October 2010 period. The advances marked a turnaround, according to Boardman, but a modest one at best. Money may be tight, but the list of needs facing lawyers continues to grow, with recurring items such as enrollment growth in public schools and the university system, plus expansion of Medicaid rolls at the top. A single figure representing the tab for all three is not yet available. In addition, lawmakers will face a number of one-time matters, including the possible need to pump more money into the state's $68 billion pension system. Whether an infusion will be necessary and how much will depend on the results of an ongoing actuarial valuation to determine whether the retirement system has enough capital to meet projected benefit payouts. Also nagging lawmakers will be the need to pump in cash to maintain state employees' benefit payouts at the current level and to handle expected growth in the state health plan. Next up, a costly surprise. Carries Pharma generic beaten to the market. By Frank Van Leeuwen. From Carry. For much of the past 2 years, Cornerstone Therapeutics has kept quiet about its work on a generic drug that could snatch most of the market from a branded cough and cold medicine that generates more than $220 million in annual sales. The Carry-based drug development company expected its generic for Tussinex would be the first to market, and it remains on track for approval by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in early 2011. But in the span of a few weeks, Cornerstone's generic has gone from being the expected first generic to being a possible third interim, and so have the prospects of the drug being a segment leader. A competitor has received FDA approval for its product, and Belgium-based UCB, which sells Tussinex, is working on its own generic. If we're third, it creates more pricing pressure, and you're splitting the pie three ways, says Cornerstone CEO Craig Collard, and he concedes, the first person gets a bigger piece of the pie. Tussinex's FDA approval dates 1987, and its patents have long expired. Jennifer Fox, a patent attorney at Coates & Bennett in Cary, says it's rare to see a branded drug whose patents have expired have no generic competition. Generics companies typically decide which drugs to make by targeting drugs with expiring patents. Collard says Tussinex has had no generic competition so far because it's hard to make that kind of long-acting drug in a liquid suspension. Cornerstone's generic allows the release of the active ingredient over an extended period of time. Cornerstone licensed its technology from Texas-based Neos Therapeutics and has spent about $5 million developing its Tussinex generic. The public company, which specializes in respiratory drugs, reported $27.9 million in third-quarter revenue. Even without a patent protection, Tussinex remains a solid product for UCB, generating about $226 million in U.S. sales, according to IMS Health data. The drug is not cheap. 2 ounces of the liquid medicine costs $58, says Stephanie Ferrari, a professor of pharmacy at UNC's Eshelman School of Pharmacy. Ferrari says Tussinex is preferred by many doctors because it works so well. Even though the cough and cold market is crowded with many products, she says few offer the combination of a cough product with an antihistamine for congestion. But last month, Par Pharmaceutical Companies announced that its licensing partner, Tres Pharma, had received approval for its Tussinex generic. Collard says he didn't know others were working on generic Tussinex, and he concedes there could still be others. But he says the difficulty in making the drug combination will probably keep the field small. Par's market advantage is not completely secure. The first generic to the market usually captures most of the market share, Ferrari says, but sometimes a second or third product can perform better. She points to Merck's cholesterol drug, Mevacor, whose patents expired in 2001. She says the first generic to market initially captured the most market share, but the second generic proved to have fewer side effects and became the better seller. Collard says supply issues could affect Par's sales. He says if Cornerstone gets approval for its generic before Par resolves its supply issues, Cornerstone could improve its market position. The following article is titled In-Kind Giving Boosts Charity by James Gallagher from Raleigh. The down economy has actually proved to be a boon for the National Cancer Center Coalition, a Raleigh nonprofit whose contributions primarily are in the form of donated medicines from pharmaceutical companies. The coalition, which provides the drugs and medical devices it receives to hospitals and cancer patients in developing nations, has experienced a surge in cash and in-kind donations, which are measured as revenue. the nonprofit's top line grew from $120 million in 2007 to $169.8 million in 2009, and the 2010 number, which has not been finalized, will eclipse 2009, says Executive Director Rob Landry. The growth has been enough to propel the nonprofit to number 107 on the Chronicle of Philanthropy's Top 400 list, up from number 138 a year ago. The NCC is the only Triangle Area nonprofit on the list to post an increase in donations during the year, and the Chronicle lists the coalition among organizations that it expects to continue growing, with 2010 revenue projected to come in at around $179.5 million. The upward momentum for NCC comes at a time when donors are scaling back. Total giving in the U.S. fell by 2.4% in 2008 and by another 3.2% in 2009 to $303 billion, the lowest amount given since 2004, according to figures compiled by Giving USA, a nonprofit that tracks giving. Landry attributes the growth of the Cancer Coalition to the partnerships that the organization has built over the past 5 years. The organization receives the bulk of its donations from pharmaceutical companies, including Pfizer, Merck, Becton Dickinson, Abbott Labs, and Johnson & Johnson, in the form of drugs and treatments. "Our relationships are really bearing fruit," he says. "We've been very fortunate to come through the economy in very good shape. But fortune likely has less to do with the organization's success than a shift in the way corporations, notably pharmaceutical companies, look to make their donations. Companies are giving fewer dollars and more in-kind gifts and are giving to organizations that fit within their industry." The planets aligned for an organization like that, said Wendy McGreedy, vice president of the Curtis Group, a Virginia Beach-based fundraising consulting firm. While total donations fell in 2008 and 2009, corporate giving actually grew last year, reaching $14.1 billion, according to Giving USA. The bulk of that growth was due to in-kind donations from technology equipment and pharmaceutical companies. A study by the Committee Encouraging Corporate Philanthropy found that companies boosted their in-kind donations by 16%. The change comes as corporations cut costs and their foundations watched endowments fall. "Companies were looking at other ways to give back to their partners," says Allison Rose, the committee's manager of standards and measurement, adding that 22% of the companies polled said they chose in-kind donations because they had the inventory on hand. At the same time, companies are more frequently working to align their philanthropic efforts with their core business. The rationale is that the companies can use their expertise to better push the needle for societal improvement. For a pharmaceutical company, this means working with organizations that deal in healthcare. McGreedy says the goal is to build brand awareness through philanthropic efforts. "They're supporting their business goals," she says. The Merck Medical Outreach Program, which donates products to people who need them, is one of the company's major donation programs, says company spokesman James Brinkman. Merck has provided more than $2.9 million worth of Timodar and Emend to the National Cancer Coalition for use in Latin America. Of course, the scenario could change rather quickly for NCC. Rose says in-kind giving tends to be the most volatile kind. Factors such as inventory, disaster relief demands, and large one-time gifts play a role in that volatility. Next up, "Hospital Bottom Lines Robust, But Free Care Bulge Feared," by James Gallagher. From Raleigh, "The area's hospitals posted positive financial results through the last fiscal year, though charity care outlays could become a drag going forward. Duke University Health System, UNC Hospitals, and Rex Healthcare all experienced revenue growth, minimized their expense growth, and posted profits during the fiscal year ending June 30, 2010, according to audits filed with the state. WakeMed Health and Hospitals concluded its fiscal year on September 30th and has not completed its audit. At the same time, demand for free care has yet to skyrocket, as many predicted 2 years ago. With many losing jobs and their accompanying insurance, it seemed logical that demand for free care would rise, but that has yet to happen. Rex's charity care was largely flat, with charges of $45 million in 2009 and $44 million in 2010, while UNC's charity care fell more from 2009 to 2010, from $138.3 million in charges to $121.8 million. Charity charges reflect how much the hospital would have charged for the procedures, not the cost to the hospital to perform the procedure. The actual cost of care ranges from 30% to 45% of charges, depending on the hospital. Duke was the only organization to post a substantial increase in charity care, with charges of $205.4 million in 2010, up from $145.1 million a year ago. But those figures alone are misleading. Ken Morris, Duke's CFO, says that the health system, which includes Duke University Hospital, Duke Raleigh Hospital, and Durham Regional Hospital, broaden the eligibility criteria for its charity care program. While that change resulted in an increased charity care provided, it reduced the hospital's bad debt write-offs from $75.3 million in actual cost in 2009 to $37.8 million in 2010. Duke's total cost of charity care and bad debt actually fell from about $123 million in 2009 to $102 million in 2010. Bad debt is unpaid bills the hospital does not expect to collect. It results from the uninsured who do not qualify for charity care and some insured who cannot afford their copays or deductibles. UNC's write-off for bad debt grew slightly from $43.6 million to $47.9 million, while Rex's fell from $27.4 million to $22.9 million. Dr. Kevin Schulman, a professor of health management at Duke's Fuqua School of Business, says people are avoiding going to the doctor because they are afraid of the financial consequences. Health providers have seen demand for elective surgeries and prescriptions go down among the insured, and even the uninsured are putting off seeking care, keeping charity care demand and bad debt write-offs down. Still, says Schumann, barring some miraculous economic turnaround, demand for charity care is going to grow between now and 2014, when health care reform legislation is scheduled to be implemented. Legislatures facing huge budget deficits are going to look closely at funding for Medicaid and the state's Children's Health Insurance Program, and small businesses are going to continue to drop insurance coverage benefits. The poor are going to find it harder to get access to public insurance, he says. Chris Ellington, UNC Hospital CFO, says that over the past 6 months, the hospital has seen greater demand for free care. Ellington expects the charity care numbers to be worse in fiscal 2011, though he is not sure how much demand will grow through the last 9 months of the fiscal year. The less-than-expected charity care, coupled with a focus on managing costs and improving investments, largely enabled the area's health systems to turn profits during the past year. Duke reported the net income of nearly $169 million, while UNC reported net income of $85 million, and Rex of $46.8 million. Wake Med, while its audit is not final, has reported that it posted net income of $45.9 million during fiscal 2010. The results represent a remarkable turnaround from 2009, when Duke, Rex, and UNC posted year-end losses due to drops in their investments. We lost money on our investments but made money on operations, says Bernadette Spong, Rex's CFO. If you're going to lose one place or another, you want to lose it on the investment side, not the operations side. Still, the hospitals remain worried about the impact that Medicare, Medicaid, and health care reform will have on their bottom lines. Medicare and Medicaid fail to pay the full cost of services, hospital officials say, and there is a concern that health care reform could exacerbate that problem. Reform will reduce the number of uninsured by moving many individuals onto Medicaid programs, which should reduce the amount of free care hospitals provide. However, hospital officials say they are concerned that the newly insured will flood their facilities, overloading them with patients who pay for some, but not all, of the care. Ellington estimates that UNC Hospitals needs to trim its costs by 10% between 2014 and 2018 to be able to deal with health care reform policies. Novozymes place ethanol research work in Franklinton, by Frank Van Leeuwen. From Franklinton, enzymes maker Novozymes is consolidating its biodiesel R&D efforts and moving much of that work to Franklinton, where the Danish company has its U.S. headquarters and large research and manufacturing operations. Cynthia Bryant, Novozymes Director of Global Marketing for Biomass, says the consolidation moves biodiesel R&D to the biofuels group. The change will result in the hiring of 5 to the company's starch R&D team in North Carolina. Before the consolidation, biodiesel R&D was part of Novozymes Oils and Fats Industry Group based in Denmark. Bryant says the Franklinton facility has expertise in starch enzymes, the kind used in making ethanol from starches such as corn. Bryant says much of the work that happens in Franklinton will have applications in the U.S. market. It makes sense for us to have our R&D resources focused in this market because the market for ethanol is so huge, she says. The U.S. ethanol production is projected to reach more than 12 billion gallons in 2010, up from 10.6 billion gallons in 2009, according to the Renewable Fuels Association, an ethanol trade group. Matt Hartwig, a spokesman for the group, says production is expected to grow as the basket of feedstocks for ethanol production grows. Right now, most ethanol in the United States is made from corn. The next step is cellulosic ethanol, ethanol made from agricultural waste, such as the leaves and stalks of corn plants. Novozymes is the global and U.S. leader in enzymes for starch-based ethanol. The company also launched the first commercial enzyme for cellulosic ethanol in February. Bryant says Novozymes has more than 50% of the enzyme market for starch-based ethanol. The Federal Renewable Fuels Standard is sparking R&D work on biofuels, including cellulosic ethanol. The law requires that the amount of renewable fuel blended into the nation's fuel supply increase from 9 billion gallons blended in 2008 to 36 billion gallons by 2022. Cellulosic biofuels are targeted to comprise 16 billion gallons of the total. Novozymes reported third quarter sales of $1.37 billion. About 18% of the company's revenue comes from sales to the biofuel industry. Ethanol represents a larger opportunity for Novozymes in the United States because it is an additive to gasoline, the primary fuel used by vehicles, Bryant says. In other parts of the world, the main liquid fuel is diesel, so most of Novozymes' biodiesel opportunities are outside the United States. A total of 545 million gallons of biodiesel were produced in the United States in 2009, according to the National Biodiesel Board. Novozymes does have local R&D efforts related to biodiesel. The company is working with Piedmont Biofuels in Pittsburgh on a pilot project that tests a new biofuel manufacturing process that reduces waste and allows producers to use a wider range of feedstocks. Novozymes spokeswoman Paige Donnelly says the plant is making batches of between 40 and 80 gallons in a lab and 35-gallon batches using the pilot unit. Next up, Pozen aims for Latin America and Europe with Trexamet. By Frank Van Leeuwen. From Franklinton. Enzymes maker Novozymes is consolidating its biodiesel R&D efforts and moving much of that work to Franklinton, where the Danish company has its U.S. headquarters and large research and manufacturing operations. Cynthia Bryant, Novozymes Director of Global Marketing for Biomass, says the consolidation moves biodiesel R&D to the Biofuels Group, headed by Franklinton-based Vice President of R&D, Steen Jokold Jorgensen. The change will result in the hiring of 5 to the company's starch R&D team in North Carolina. Before the consolidation, biodiesel and R&D was part of the Novozymes Oils and Fats Industry Group, based in Denmark. Bryant says the Franklinton facility has expertise in starch enzymes, the kind used in making ethanol from starches, such as corn. Bryant says much of the work that happens in Franklinton will have applications in the U.S. market. It makes sense for us to have our R&D resources funded in this market because the market for ethanol is so huge, she says. U.S. ethanol production is projected to reach more than 12 billion gallons in 2010, up from 10.6 billion gallons in 2009, according to the Renewable Fuels Association, an ethanol trade group. Matt Hartwick, a spokesman for the group, says production is expected to grow as the basket of feedstocks for ethanol production grows. Right now, most ethanol in the United States is made from corn. The next step is cellulosic ethanol, ethanol made from agricultural waste such as the leaves and stalks of corn plants. Novozymes is the global and U.S. leader in enzymes for starch-based ethanol. The company also launched the first commercial enzyme for cellulosic ethanol in February. Bryant says Novozymes has more than 50% of the enzyme market for starch-based ethanol. The Federal Renewable Fuels Standard is sparking R&D work on biofuels, including cellulosic ethanol. The law requires that the amount of renewable fuel blended into the nation's fuel supply increase from the 9 billion gallons blended in 2008 to 36 billion gallons by 2022. Cellulosic biofuels are targeted to comprise 16 billion gallons of the total. Novozymes reported third quarter sales of $1.37 billion. About 18% of the company's revenue comes from the sales to the biofuel industry. Ethanol represents a larger opportunity for Novozymes in the United States because it is an additive to gasoline, the primary fuel used by vehicles, Bryant says. In other parts of the world, the main liquid fuel is diesel, so most of Novozymes' biodiesel opportunities are outside the United States. A total of 545 million gallons of biodiesel were produced in the United States in 2009, according to the National Biodiesel Board. Novozymes does have local R&D efforts related to biodiesel. The company is working with Piedmont Biofuels in Pittsburgh on a pilot project that tests a new biodiesel manufacturing process that reduces waste and allows producers to use a wider range of feedstocks. Novozymes spokeswoman Paige Donnelly says the plant is making batches of between 40 and 80 gallons in a lab and 35-gallon batches using the pilot unit. The following article reads, Feds launch criminal probe into Gateway merger and loans, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. The criminal division of the U.S. Justice Department has subpoenaed Virginia-based Hampton Roads Bank shares for records relating to its December 2008 merger with Gateway Bank. Hampton Roads, which operates a five-branch network under the Gateway name in the Triangle, disclosed the DOJ action in a November 9 filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The subpoena arrived at the Norfolk Bank on November 2nd. Hampton says the information sought by federal investigators focuses on the merger and on loans made by Gateway Financial Holdings and its subsidiary, Gateway Bank, before the Hampton merger. The DOJ has informed Hampton Roads that it is not a target of the investigation at this time, Hampton Roads managers say in the SEC filing. Asked to elaborate, Hampton Roads counsel Douglas Glenn said he can't go beyond what's in the bank's SEC filings. At the time of the 2008 merger, Gateway had 37 branches, about evenly split between central and coastal North Carolina and coastal Virginia. Gateway at the time operated dual headquarters in Elizabethtown in Bladen County near Wilmington and in Virginia Beach. The bank's Triangle expansion came in 2007 and early 2008. Where the loans mentioned in the government's subpoena originally were made is a matter not discussed in the Hampton Roads SEC filings. Publicly traded Hampton Roads says at this point it does not believe the existence of any DOJ probe should have a material effect on the bank. However, it does add that we can give you no assurances as to the timing or eventual outcome of this investigation. Peter Carr, a spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Virginia in Alexandria, declined to say whether his office is leading the investigation. We never disclose the existence of subpoenas if it's a grand jury matter, he says. Robin Zier, a spokeswoman for the DOJ's Eastern District of North Carolina, also declined to comment on the same grounds. Founded by veteran banker Ben Berry in 1998, Gateway ran into difficulties in 2008 when the government put mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac into conservatorship, a move that devalued the price of the Fannie Mae preferred shares that made up a sizable portion of Gateway's financial base. Berry and his executive team looked for a cash infusion, finally settling on the merger with Hampton Roads. Hampton, with about $1 billion in total assets, acquired Gateway with $2 billion for $100 million. The new institution that emerged from that merger had about 15% of its loan portfolio stemming from deals in the Triangle. Repeated attempts to reach Berry, who went on to organize a private investment group, were not successful. Next up, small utilities want to count progress credits as theirs. By Frank Van Leeuwen, from Raleigh. Eastern North Carolina cities that provide electricity within their borders, much of it bought off the grid, says energy generated from renewable sources and purchased from Progress Energy should count as credits against state mandates they face, a practice consumer advocates say would be a form of double dipping. The NC Utilities Commission's public staff, saying municipals can't count the energy as renewable twice, is challenging how munis plan to comply with the state's renewable energy targets. The public staff is set up to represent consumer interests in the utilities cases. The North Carolina Eastern Municipal Power Agency, which buys power for 32 cities, including Apex, Clayton, and Wake Forest, argues that because Progress Energy has secured renewable energy, the power it buys from Progress is renewable. The NCEMPA buys 24.3% of its power from Progress. Gary Brunall, a senior director at consulting firm R.W. Beck, says in testimony filed with the commission that the municipals are complying with the plain language of a 2007 state law, setting renewable energy targets for electricity wholesalers to meet. He says the law states that if a wholesaler's portfolio meets the renewable energy requirements, a municipality purchasing all or a portion of its electric power from that wholesale supplier complies with the statute. It's an important issue. By 2021, 12.5% of generation from Progress and Duke Energy must be renewable. For municipals and electric cooperatives, the target is 10% renewable generation by 2018. Although all utilities are striving to meet renewable energy goals, municipals and electric cooperatives have slightly different requirements. Their customers are protected by a price cap that's designed to limit how much cost gets passed on to ratepayers, says James McClawhorn, director of the public staff's electric division. Once a utility reaches the cap, it is deemed in compliance with the renewable energy requirement, regardless of how much energy has been saved. The money that municipals and co-ops spend on programs for energy efficiency, reducing peak demand and renewable power purchases counts against the cap, which was $3.3 million in 2008. McClawhorn says that for what the municipals are spending, they could be saving more energy. You're not getting a lot of bang for your buck, McClawhorn says. NCEMPA Manager of Planning Andrew Fusco says the agency has run cost-benefit tests that show more benefit than cost. He adds that the NCEMPA is taking steps to be prudent about its renewable energy expenses. The agency is acquiring renewable energy certificates now to count toward renewable energy compliance requirements in the future, which Fusco says is a better deal for customers. On that point, the public staff disagrees. McClawhorn says renewable energy credit, or REC, purchases should count as an expense the year they're purchased, the same way Progress and cooperative utilities count them. The North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association is aware of the dispute, but has not gotten involved at this point, spokeswoman Julie Robinson says. Member-owned cooperatives, which, like municipals, buy much of their power from other providers, are also watching. North Carolina co-ops formed a company called Greenco Solutions, which acquires renewable energy on behalf of co-ops. Progress must acquire enough renewable energy generation to fulfill its own targets. but the utility also arranges to secure renewable power for the smaller utilities that buy wholesale power. Greenco's purchases, for example, are done with agreements to ensure that Greenco properly receives the RECs tied to that power, McClawhorn says. NCEMPA has no such agreements with Progress. The North Carolina Utilities Commission is still weighing the matter and has yet to issue a ruling. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Today's article is titled Study Validates Vitality of Arts Sector. The Philanthropy News Desk, written by Todd Cohen. The creative sector in Durham and Wake counties is thriving. Despite the recession, the number of highly creative jobs grew by nearly 10% to 6,608 in Durham County from 2006 to 2008, and by nearly 2.5% to 14,624 in Wake County, according to a new report. In 2008, the report says nonprofit arts groups and nonprofits active in the arts earned more than $28 million in revenue in Durham County and $150 million in Wake County. Those are among a broad range of metrics in the reports, which for the first time provides a creative vitality index that gauges the health of the creative economy in the two counties. The strength of the creative economies in Durham and Wake, including both the nonprofit and for-profit sectors, exceeded those of North Carolina and the United States in 2008. The strength of Durham's creative economy exceeded that of the United States by 26% and North Carolina's by 90%, while Wake's exceeded that of the United States by 28% and North Carolina's by 95%. We're above average and doing fairly well, says Eleanor Oakley, president and CEO of the United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County. We compete fairly strongly nationally, she says. Sherry DeVries, executive director of the Durham Arts Council, says Durham historically has enjoyed a strong nonprofits arts sector and in the past few years has seen a surge in the for-profit arts sector, resulting in a critical mass of art activity in Durham overall. The study, prepared by the two counties by Western States Arts Federation, uses the number one to represent a national baseline. Durham exceeded that baseline by 25% in 2006, 22% in 2007, and 26% in 2008, while Wake exceeded it by 29% in 2006, 19% in 2007, and 28% in 2008. In 2008, creative occupations per capita in Durham exceeded the national average by 75% and the statewide average by 218%, while creative occupations in Wake exceeded the national average by 18% and the statewide average by 46%. Oakley says Western States Arts Federation compared an 8-county region that includes Wake, Durham, to 20 peer metro areas, including those the region typically competes with in recruiting corporate headquarters, and found the region ranked 7th. Oakley and DeVries says the arts sector in both counties continues to cope with the economic downturn and has benefited from government investment. DeVries says she anticipates growth in performing arts participation, overall arts revenue, and probably in individual artist sales. As part of its work to support the arts, the Durham Arts Council provides training programs to help artists develop and grow their businesses. Oakley says, it is good news that none of the 45 largest nonprofit arts groups in Wake County have gone out of business. The trick in a period of years like this, she says, is to hang on, make plans for better times, and try to maintain as much of your programming momentum as you can. And now from the opinion page. It's my turn, from Dale Gibson. City's truck assassinates limb. A few years ago, I took Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen to task for his idea to change the city's trash collection from yard pickup to curbside pickup. All he had to do was convince the City Council to go along. I lamented that the move would take the City of Oaks back to the Neanderthal period in terms of customer service. Worse yet, I said it'd put us in the same class as Rock Hill, South Carolina, a nondescript dot on the map where Allen worked before he came here. If nothing else, Allen is persistent. He made the financial argument to the council how much money the new system would save. To the citizens, he offered bribes in the form of sturdy plastic bins with wheels they could easily roll to the street. To those unable to handle the big green trash cans, he said the city's sanitation workers would pick them up in the yard. The deck was stacked against me, as it was back when I argued that what's now the RBC Center should be built in downtown Raleigh and not out yonder by Carter Finley Stadium. I lost the arena argument, and I also lost the trash can argument. Now, I know something else about Russell Allen. He holds a grudge. I know that because when I got home a week ago, it was a Friday, my trash pickup day. My trash can was perched cockeyed under my big crepe myrtle tree, right beside my recycling bucket, and right beside a big old limb that had been torn off my beautiful tree. "Dagnabbit," I proclaimed. Actually, the language was a bit more colorful than that, but I can't use such words here. "Dagnabbit." Russell Allen told his sanitation crew to jack up that one-armed bandit that picks up the trash cans and knock down my limb for all the fuss I made over his trash pickup idea. Revenge is sweet, Allen must be thinking. Well, what am I going to do about this? I pondered my decision and came to one very conclusive conclusion. I ain't touching that limb. The sanitation people tore it off my tree. They'll be the ones to come and clean it up. By now, it was too late on Friday to call anyone in the city government. It was after 4, so I was left with an entire weekend to ponder the sad situation in which my glorious tree will have to go into next spring minus one of its prized appendages. What, I wondered, is a limb worth on a mature crepe myrtle tree? I thought about calling Tom Hendrickson, who at one time had a company that put a value on landscaping, but thought better of it. He might want to charge me a fee. So I went about my weekend mess, playing a little golf, swimming at the downtown Y, the real YMCA, and piddling. To be honest, I didn't give much more thought to my murdered limb, even though it made my yard look kind of messy. On Monday, though, after wading through the city of Raleigh's infernally bad website, I found a phone number that purported to be customer service for the sanitation department. Now, you know this part. I found myself in voicemail hell, pushing this number and that, and finally being given the tone. You know the tone. You're on hold for some seriously bad music playing, and every couple of minutes the recording begins that, "Your call is important to us." After about 10 minutes of this, which could have been much worse, I found out that customer service at the sanitation department means you get someone named Chester. I explained to Chester what had happened. He did it in a polite way, but his question was essentially, "What do you want us to do about it?" "Come pick it up and take it away," I told Chester. "I'm going to have to check with somebody else," Chester said. "I haven't come across this before." Chester came back with a couple more questions before telling me I'd have to make a claim. "I don't want to make a claim," I told Chester. "I just want the limb gone." "Sorry, you'll have to talk to this lady," and he transferred me to her. I left a message with this lady, and the next day she called me back. I told her what I wanted, and she said it would be done. And it was by the time I got home that day. I'm just glad that she and Chester didn't know that Russell Allen might not have liked them helping me this way, given the way he got back at me for trashing his trash pickup idea. And from Triangle Biz, some untoward incidents have happened at Duke University of late, such as the Duke College Republicans leader being impeached for being gay, crude, fraternity emails sent to social listservs, and a sanctioned tailgating party being shut down due to well-drunken behavior. So what's a college president to do? Richard Broadhead wants Duke students to channel their inner selves to bring about change. Seriously. Here's what Broadhead wrote in an email to the student body, according to the Duke Chronicle. Quote, "To the extent that there are features of student culture that strike you as less than ideal, I urge you to face up to them, speak openly about them, and have the courage to visualize a change. We won't succeed in making Duke the best place it could be unless you make that your personal project, as you shape your own conduct and your collective life." End quote. How about a collective spanking? We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRR website momentarily. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.